24th, 2022 quarterly public forum of the Denver Citizen Oversight Board. I'm Dr. April Alexander, Vice Chair of the Citizen Oversight Board, welcoming you to this forum this evening. Just want to give you some orientation to how tonight's events will go. We'll start off with some general announcements and logistics of how the evening will proceed and just giving you some updates. Then we will have a guest here today who we will be talking to about a number of different issues. That guest will be Executive Director of the Department of Public Safety, Armando Saldante. So they should be arriving shortly. A series of those questions will involve just asking for some updates regarding the 112 recommendations from the Reimagining Policing Task Force. Also asking about the Department of Safety's involvement in addressing homelessness in the community, and then some general Department of Safety staffing issues that have come up over the last few board meetings. We will give you all the opportunity to ask community questions throughout, or we will have time at the end for individuals to ask questions. Our board members might also ask questions periodically throughout before we open it up to the community. For those who are a little less familiar with Zoom, you can either put your questions in the chat, but that can become a little bulky. So I'd highly recommend that you put them in the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen so we can be sure to filter those questions and make sure that we address them at the end. So I just want to announce the members of the Citizen Oversight Board real quick and do some quick introductions. First, we have Julia Richmond, who is our chair. She's unable to be here tonight as she's engaged in other civic duties in our community. We have Karen Collier, Al Gardner, Stefan Stein, Terrence Carroll, Nikki Brazel, Larry Martinez, and our newest member, Nicholas Weber. And we wanted to give Nicholas, since this is his first quarterly public forum, the opportunity to just introduce himself to the community.
So good evening, everybody. My name is Nicholas Weber. Like Dr. April Alexander said, I work at the Colorado State Public Defender's Office. I'm an attorney at the trial office in Denver, one of 22 offices throughout the state of Colorado. Grew up in Denver, lived abroad throughout the United States in a couple different states, but happy to be back. Have been here since 2014 and really excited to be on board and contributing to the community as a member of the Citizen Oversight Board. Thank you, Dr. Alexander.
Not a problem. Again, as we are introducing Nick to the board, we also wanted to announce that the city will be accepting applications for another seat on the board very soon. So if you want to join the board or know someone who might be a good fit for the board, you can email us at cob@denvergov.org. That is cob@denvergov.org. And we'll make sure that you're notified when those seats open and when we're accepting applications. One of the things that we're working on as a board right now is just thinking about ways to diversify our board in a number of different ways. And so we would love to hear from folks in community on their recommendations or self-recommendations for the board. Also, as another major community update, as you know, we are in the process of hiring for the independent monitor. We had hoped that we would be announcing today the recruiter that we're working with, but there have been some delays in the city contracting process that have been longer than anticipated. We're thinking that they're going to be signing the contract very soon, and we will issue a press release shortly thereafter with the name of recruiter, as well as all of the members of the screening committee. So please be on the lookout either in our newsletter or in our social media for that announcement, hopefully in the next couple weeks. Again, as we are broadcasted live on Channel 8, just being sure that all of our Channel 8 viewers can email their questions into us anytime during this process tonight. We will probably get to them towards the end after Director Saldante does his introductions. You can email your questions to COB at denvergov.org. Again, that is COB@denvergov.org. And so we will do that in this process. All right, so we will jump right into our guest again today who arrived. Thank you so much. We have Executive Director of the Department of Public Safety here, Armando Saldante. Again, addressing a few topics that we submitted previously that have been ongoing topics through our quarterly public forums, as well as our bi-monthly citizen oversight board meetings as well. So first and foremost, thank you for your time here tonight at our quarter publicly forum. I know this is your first one. So again, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. Can you all hear me okay?
Just want to make sure.
Yes,
we can.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you all for the time and for the opportunity to visit with the citizen oversight board and to be participating in this public forum. I appreciate you all had sent over some questions. I could dive right into them, but I don't want to limit it to just these questions. If anything else comes up, please, I'm here for the whole time. So please get to them. And if we don't get to any questions, I will follow up and me and my staff will follow up and provide written responses if that's what we need to do. So first of all, you all asked about an update on the progress of the department's public dashboard for tracking responses to the 112 task force recommendations for transforming public safety in Denver. So when you really want to know when it's going to be complete and kind of the status. So I do have some notes. I don't typically go off notes, but I want to make sure I got it all because my team provided a pretty detailed response here. So I want to make sure that I get all that. But just first, I want to start off with that I've been committed and our team has been committed to really going through every one of these recommendations with the same vigor and thoroughness that the task force did. And the task force, you know, spent some time over a year in developing these, and we've had these about a year. And what I want everyone also to understand is that these are not 112 recommendations just for the Department of Public Safety. These were recommendations that also touched other city departments and other non-city departments or other departments that are outside of that, like the district attorney's office or other entities like the legislative process and things like that. So, but we've done our best in the Department of Safety to put our arms around all of it, to coordinate these responses and to make sure that every response that touched on any entity or agency that has been vetted through all of those. So when I talk about this, and then also I'll tell you that for me and me devoting time and staff to this, we've pretty much devoted one full-time FTE at a director position with really all, she works at least 40 hours a week on this and then also communicating with other departments. I'll tell you, other city leadership gets together on these as well. And we provide our input and all that is evidenced in the dashboard. And we've really tried to be transparent to get that. So when I get a moment, I will put it in the chat, the link to the dashboard, but any of you all can get to it, denvergov.org/safety. From our page, you can get there, you can click right to it from there and it'll tell you. And it's an interactive dashboard where you can filter out things and certain things. So when can you expect it to be complete? The executive branch is on track to meet its goal of completing a comprehensive review and response to the recommendations next month. So we were hoping and we've consistently said June was our month to hopefully get them all and all the responses out. There's anticipated that the publication of those final responses may take a little bit of time going into July. So when we go through this whole process of getting the response done, getting it done, then there is some logistics in getting it uploaded and then into the website and then published forward facing on the website to the public. Right now, the current status for all this, and I can also send this over to Daniel so maybe he can get it. So if you're not taking notes, I think that'll be helpful because I want to make sure you guys have the most up-to-date stuff. So I'll send this to you as well, Daniel, so you have it to publish. Is of the 63 published recommendations, 68% are from strategy groups 1 through 5, and 13% are declined response status, 58% are previously implemented or whole or in part, and 60% reflect a lead agency within the Department of Public Safety and 40% of those are from another city agency. And you'll see in the dashboard, it's clearly defined, like who's the entity or agency that was identified as the lead agency for something like that. So that is clearly on that. We've tried to make this very, very easy to read. And I think some of you have already visited and you know that. 25 recommendations are currently in the drafting and finalization process. That means the team has identified, all done all the background, all the research on it, and it's going into that process to where then the executives look at it and they give their thumbs up or thumbs down, and then it goes forward to publication. 24 are in the review process. We've also added a new page to the dashboard. So if you haven't been to it in some time, I encourage you to go to page 2. It was demonstrated for me today. I like it. But I'm also a data guy, so but whatever, if you also have any feedback or you want it to see a little different or you have any questions, please reach out to me or my team and we'll help you through that. We could also have a demo for you all if you need it, you know, from the person that's developed the page of how to navigate it and do things like that. That summary page like I say, it's interactive, so you can select things and the graphs will change accordingly. It has the published responses according to the strategy category that was assigned by the community task force, the response status, the lead agency, and other groupings that we thought might be of interest to the community. So like, let's say you wanna say, I wanna see all the ones in public safety that are assigned to public safety that have been implemented. And you can click on that and then it'll filter out and it'll show that. Another note about the dashboard is where a status report or whether a response status contains multiple parts, like previously implemented in part or declined in part, or there's multiple agencies that are identified as lead agencies, the dashboard lists the first listed response type of agency. So like the most, the one that's there, it's a little complicated because there are some that touched on various things and there are some where we have implemented some of it and we haven't. So we've tried to just kind of indicate that first kind of bigger one. But if you have any other questions on regards to that, like I said, we can definitely get you the full list and all that sort of background documentation. There was a question as to, are there any changes being made as a result that I would like to highlight for you all? So I wanna make sure that, thank you, Daniel, for putting the link in there. Help me out with that. The executive branch is still actively engaged in the review and response process. So it's important to note that there will be additional information to be shared by city leadership once the process is fully complete. It's also important to remember that this review and response process will result in implementations of new areas of work or change, which will not be complete by June. That's just a fancy way of saying that we are committed to doing some change, but the change won't always be immediate. Like it's gonna take time and process to get some of these changes in, but that will be communicated. And what I also want to make sure is that this just doesn't all reside with me saying yes or no. This is really a full level all the way to the mayor, and some of these really take on that kind of leadership that has had input in this. And so we will be clear to let and delineate when that is. We'd also like to highlight there's a parallel path that the executive branch and the task force have been on for 2 years. While the task force was convening and developing its body of recommendations, the city was also creating changing policies and practices in some of these areas. So you can see that currently published recommendations responses, 81% of those 63 recommendations contain assets city agencies have been pursuing and are now implementing in whole or part. And we'll give you, and it doesn't seem like it may seem that we're far apart, but we're really not in a lot of things. Here's an example. Recommendation number 9, increase city funding potential for qualified community-based organizations that prioritize community care by streamlining and removing cumbersome barriers to the RFP or request for proposal or request for qualifications contracting granting process. We have in there our responses will implement. The Denver Office of Nonprofit Engagement, D1, that was formerly the Denver Office of Strategic Partnership, launched the nonprofit task force in May of 2021. And it was its purpose was to take a 360-degree look at how the city engages, funds, and utilizes its nonprofit sector. I recognize this all the time when we were talking about ARPA investment. We have a lot of community nonprofits that are in the work that we want to engage with, but that the city process or the grant process is so cumbersome. I think there's probably a lot of folks on this board that have engaged in nonprofit work, and you realize, and when it comes to grants and those type of things, that sometimes you almost need a full-time FTE or staff to go through all that. So the city's recognized that. We've recognized that's not only a challenge, it's a hurdle to get engagement with direct, especially those small nonprofits that we critically, especially in public safety, particularly in areas that have been impacted, that are impacted by crime and don't have the same opportunity that others do. Those are the nonprofits we need to engage in. And those are the ones that are limited by these cumbersome processes. So we know that there's challenges there. We are trying to work on that, and the city is trying to work on that and trying to streamline those responses for those folks. In fact, it's something that I've been asking my staff when we're trying to engage a nonprofit, is there administrative tasks that we can take on for that nonprofit to make sure that they can compete and they can utilize these dollars to where they're not spending those dollars on administrative tasks where they're spending them on clients and that outreach. Those are the things that we need to support and that we clearly recognize. There's a lot more examples. I definitely want to make sure we leave a lot of time for other responses. So if you want me to get into that, that's something definitely. I'll just look at this last one because it was one that that I worked closely on. And that was like recommendation 92, and it's implemented. Create a sanctity of life statement as a part of the Denver use of force policy. Denver Police and Denver Sheriff Department use of force policies recognizing the value and sanctity of human life. The Department of Safety adopted a sanctity of life policy recognizing the value and sanctity of human life in all public safety interactions and services effective in January 2022. It was one of the first things I did. So not only did it already reside in our police use of force and our sheriff, but I put it and I implemented it across all safety systems. So those are just kind of examples of that. So I want to get into, make sure we have enough time for our other topics, because I know my staff supplied me with a lot of examples here. So number two, the question you have is a big picture discussion about what I believe are the department's role and perhaps what its role is not in the fight against homelessness and what the strategy is for performing that role. And you pointed out, and these are words I've said, and I think I even said in a meeting earlier, when I took over for the previous executive director, Murphy Robinson, I said, we can't arrest our way out of these problems. And you asked me to, well, how does that resolve with the 1,000+ arrests at Union Station or the closure of parks, and how does that fit into our overall role and strategy? And thank you for the question. It's a tough question, and it's something that I'm glad you all posed to me, because I want to be really clear about this and homelessness and our role in homelessness. Definitely, there is not one problem that we face that arresting alone will get us out of it. Now, it's not saying that we don't arrest folks. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that arresting folks doesn't help in a situation, because I'll use the Union Station example as one of those examples. So Union Station was really publicized by a quote from one of their union officials from the employee union that referred to it as a lawless hellhole. There was then media coverage and saturation of stories of people openly using fentanyl and all kinds of things that people were experiencing, where drivers were experiencing negative behaviors, violent behaviors, those types of things, open drug fentanyl use throughout the terminal, to the point where the restrooms were so contaminated with fentanyl residue that they had to be closed and remediated. So this wasn't a made up thing. This was something that was truly a problem. When the city then started focusing that, I went down there, Murphy went down there, other folks, we then started partnering closely with RTD, their policing and their services. And what we found was, and then what we heard overwhelmingly was that they wanted more policing. People wanted more policing, that these folks were creating conditions that were dangerous, not only for passengers, commuters, for people using the station, but also for them personally, there were overdoses, there were things like that. It just was not a good environment. So police did show up. We showed up, we came in, the district, District 6 police went there. There was strategy behind it. There was a deployment of resources around it. It was not an easy problem, and nor has it been solved by any means. There are still problems that persist out there. But what we saw was an overwhelming public open air market for fentanyl. We also were very targeted in trying to have operations around the drug dealers. Was the enforcement focusing on drug dealers? However, just with that stepped up enforcement, we overwhelmingly also saw people that were using drugs, that were had paraphernalia, that were creating the unsafe conditions that were there. And so there was enforcement, there was increased police officer presence. And then you may have also seen in recent articles that maybe the violence wasn't there or wasn't what it had seemed, or in this time period, there wasn't the violent crime that we've seen. Well, I also got to say that there is also a deterrent value to all that police presence, right? There is also a deterrent value to those arrests. I'm not saying it's the only thing, because what we have also done is we've also done, and it doesn't make the headlines, but we've also done outreach in those situations. When there was ever an operation or a large-scale operation that received a lot of press, there was also an outreach, a day of outreach, where we were out there with our clinicians, where we were out there with our co-responders, where we were out there with our therapy dogs, where we were out there doing that. Now the Public Health and Environment, Department of Public Health and Environment, is stationing their mobile Winnie there and more outreach resources. So I will never say that only 1,000 arrests or that high profile law enforcement was going to solve the problem there. But part of the solution is also that public health approach. And it's also getting the outreach and the services out there. So that is one thing that I've always been a part of when I've talked about, whether it's been an initiative like street enforcement team. What was that? What did I talk about? I talked about, well, it's a non-uniform police resource that we are now deploying to encampments as that first response. And we will start off with outreach. We'll start off with connection to services, and enforcement will be that last resort, is where we really wanted that to go to. And that's what we have. We are very supportive and are very supportive of the expansion of programs like STAR and those things. We do not compete with STAR. That's not something that we're trying to even take back. That's something that we promote. We have seen the value in calls that were historically responded to by police. And those were folks that were in crisis, folks that were in those things. And we have seen the value, and we've seen how STAR can be the better response, and STAR can take care of those responses without a police officer. And those are things that I am totally in for. So I'm not saying that needs to be a part of Department of Safety or we need to get back to cops going to that. I am fully supportive of expanding STAR and getting it more out there so they can take more of those calls, because we've seen it, and we've seen it even as it grows, being a very successful model in getting response to that. So this is not something I'm saying that we just need to go back to arresting folks, because that is not something I've ever turned to or said that, even with the 1,000+ arrests out at Union Station. I just tell you, that tells you the magnitude of the problem we were dealing with over some time. But those aren't the numbers of arrests that are going on there today. And we're still addressing it through not only just enforcement and policing presence, but also through outreach. The other thing, the closure of parks, I got to talk about. So there's been two high profile closures of parks. And one was Civic Center right here, right? Civic Center was closed down. It just had gotten so bad and it gotten bad on a number, open drug use, a lot of the population that were openly drug using, causing problems. There was violent crime. There were shootings. There were all sorts of things. That was a parks decision, right? Parks decided that it needed to be remediated in a number of ways, and that they needed to get a handle on it, and they needed, and the closure was what it took. That was something that was not my decision. I don't think that was happening when I was the director at that point, but that is something. But more recently, La Alma Park was closed because there was two violent incidents, shooting incidents that occurred there. And prior, prior to that, there was also some violence where it had been closed before. The rec center had been closed. And I was so disappointed when it got closed again, or when I heard the violence again, because just weeks prior, I was at the grand reopening. Me and my staff and my team were there. It was such a joyous event. It was so great to see the kids there. And for me as a public safety official and someone that's been involved in this for a long time, I have always seen parks, rec centers, basketball courts as deterrents to crime, right? I'd rather have folks and kids engaged at those places, as opposed to going out and hanging out at who knows where and doing who knows what. I always think that those places need to stay open the best we can keep them open and keep them safe for folks to go to be those safe spaces for especially our youth to engage at, specifically in neighborhoods like La Alma and Lincoln and those neighborhoods where we have some challenges around public safety. So I wasn't involved in the dialogue around closing La Alma recently. I understand it. I understand that Parks wants to make sure their staff and everyone's safe. I definitely am sympathetic to that too. But I also want to encourage us to work together as a community to make sure that these parks don't get to these. They need to be open. They need to be open. I'm also discouraged to hear that it's sad. I think this great resignation has not only affected us, and I know we're going to get into like police staffing and those type of things, but it's also affecting our staffing for like lifeguards for our pools to be open this summer. And that's disheartening because I think back when I was a kid and I was probably not in the best neighborhood, and we always made it to our pool. And that was just such a good escape during the summer, particularly where I grew up, where it was so hot that it was. And so I hope that we as a community can really rally around our parks. I think and safety, I think we need to do our part to make sure they're safe places as well, because that is gonna be how we can combat violence and crime and a lot of these things is by having those community centers like rec centers and parks that can be safe places for our community. So that is something that's part of my overall strategy and something that I will engage at and I'll be involved with, and that whatever I can do to help that, I will make sure I support. You've asked about the likely impacts of the local impacts of the fentanyl bill recently passed by the state legislature and expected to be signed by the governor. So this is something that I ask you to give me a little bit of time on. So there was a lot on the fentanyl bill. There was a lot. The city did not have a official position on it. We were monitoring it. We were watching it. Obviously, fentanyl is a problem. We've seen it. We see it in our communities. We've seen it, unfortunately, through way too many overdose deaths in regards to fentanyl, but not only fentanyl, methamphetamine and other drugs. But fentanyl has been something that scares a lot of us that have been in this field for some time. It's a drug like no one's ever seen. And it's really something that we were watching closely. There were a lot of last minute amendments that I have not kept up on. In fact, I think that I'm gonna be scheduled to be in a briefing on kind of what was the fallout of it and where did it land and what is signed and how it goes. I will tell you that from what I heard and the things that we got to, and I think especially around the treatment and those types of things, I was really encouraged by. I really applaud the legislature, our legislative leaders, Speaker Garnett and others that took this on. What, no matter where they were at on the bill, every one of them had a side and a position, and I understand it. I applaud them for taking it on. It's very hard. I don't know the right answer to it myself. It's a very hard issue, but I do applaud them taking it on and trying to do their best with it. I look forward to getting briefed on it. And I really don't want to just speak out of turn because there were so many last minute amendments. I was a little confused on where it was landing and what was landing on. I will tell you, I've heard that there's some very positive things out of it, especially around their treatments and things like that, and maybe resourcing of that. I do believe that the possession limit went from 4 grams to 1, if I think I'm correct on that, which I think is a good thing. I think, you know, fentanyl is very deadly, even very, very small instances, and having the ability to have some enforcement teeth to it when it comes to a felony or not is, I think, important. It's also important into, I think, encouraging folks, and I know some people disagree with this, but encouraging folks into some sort of treatment. I will tell you, I had a family member in that predicament, and it was, and it did encourage them to make a change in their addiction cycle. So I say that from experience. I know that's not spread across everyone's experience. Everyone has different experience. So, but I just share that with me. That was mine. So I will, and let's talk about this as another thing once I get it further. And then let's also look at the data. Like with anything, let's look at how it plays out. Let's see how it may, how changes in this legislation may or may not impact crime. I know our legislators, we have a lot of, I'm really good, and they're close on this issue, and I'm sure they're gonna look at the data on this and let's see it. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it plays out, but I'm gonna get briefed on it and I'll keep you all posted on what I hear about it and what transpires with that. A look at what the street enforcement team has been doing and what can be done to increase the number of contacts that result in a referral to available services, which is reportedly around 6%. And you ask the million-dollar question, why are people refusing city services? And I'm not just going to limit that to city services, but services deliveries across the spectrum. Because it's not only city personnel that go out and engage with folks that are experiencing homelessness or experiencing crisis out in our streets. We have nonprofits that do this work. Some do it through contracts with the city. Others do it on their own. We have faith-based organizations. We have a lot of folks. We have people's own family that go out there and try to make a difference with their family members that may be out experiencing crisis or in addiction cycles or living out on the streets. It's very difficult for someone to logically say, especially like, let's say when you throw in cold weather, right? I remember being out, this was during, not this last winter, but the winter before, I was out with our early intervention team at the time. And it was when we were having record cold one night, you know, or one day, and it was like minus 22 was the feels like temperature. And I was thinking to myself, as cold as I was, and I was bundled up and prepared, I was thinking like, when we go out to people, they're going to want to come inside. This is just so crazy cold. And people were saying no. And you can't, and you can't apply logic to that because, or you can't think of that. You got to think of that differently. People are, each person out there had their own story of why they're out there. They have their own struggles. They have their own story on why they don't want to go to the shelter or come in. They have their own physical or mental health things that are happening to them that are getting in the way of maybe the reason of saying, maybe we should go inside and not get frostbite or do that. And one of those is a very strong drug addiction in some cases. You know, that is hard to overcome. And that's hard for people when your body and physiological response to this addiction is that you are just wanting to get your next hit of an opioid or something like that. It is hard to convince someone in that cycle to come in because of that. And so I get that. I get that. And I'm very sympathetic to that. I know that there are a lot of people in this space, and our outreach workers, I give them so much credit because they go out there every day despite being told no, or despite meeting, you know, people that aren't ready to make a choice to come inside. They go out there every day trying to make a difference and trying to encourage people to get to a better spot and try to encourage them into making a life-altering decision or to get to that next step of recovery, which isn't easy for anyone in an addiction cycle. And then also engaging with people that may have untreated mental illness and trying to get them into a space. And these folks, I want to acknowledge that our outreach workers are they have a very difficult job and they are trying very hard to get people into the space. And I just want to acknowledge that it's not that they're not doing a good job when people are refusing, it's just very difficult. And so I really want to acknowledge that. And I also want to acknowledge that they experience trauma when they go out. It's not easy for them. I've talked to our outreach workers. I've been with them when they've had a hard day of outreach or when they've been out with someone that is pregnant, that is using, and they can't get them to a better spot and how that weighs on them and how they think they failed. So I want to just say that I think if we all wish that people would accept these services, come in from outside or get a better, but that's just not the reality that we're dealing with, but people are trying hard and people are making a difference and there are successes and wins out there. There aren't enough, but they are making success, and they aren't just spinning their wheels, and they aren't just wasting their time out there. They are doing some really good work. So I do want to say that, yes, we got to do better. Yes, we got to figure out how we could get people more induced into this type of, you know, those commitments. I think a big part of that is what we are doing in the jail environment. And I'm not saying everyone that's homeless has been through the jail, but there are folks that leave the jail into homelessness and come into the jail into homelessness and in addiction and in mental illness. And what we are doing there and what we're working on there, and I think you might have met with Sheriff Dickens, hopefully he's been able to brief you on this, is our medically assisted treatment program. And I applaud what Denver Health is helping us with this. I was there with our chief psychiatrist, Dr. James, with our chief psychologist and Dr. Nikki Johnson, the sheriff, and I went to Kenton County, Kentucky just recently to witness a program and see a program that is a national model around medically assisted treatment and treatment. And what we saw was a very engaged people that were in custody, that were engaged in treatment and engaged in medically assisted treatment. And what I took away from that, because we had an opportunity to talk to all of them, and what I took away, and that's something that we need to learn from and do more of here, was what gave those folks hope in their treatment was that when they were released, they had a plan, they had medically assisted treatment supports, and they had, you know, they had somewhere to go to, a residential treatment facility, a housing situation. And that's where we're really lacking on our side of where we're at now today, where our folks that are released from jail are still released out into the same crisis they're in or in the same addiction cycle. So what we're trying to do in the jail and what we're trying to do with other initiatives here in safety is really help bridge that gap from release, whatever kind of release, whether you're being released on pretrial release, whether you're being released post-conviction, or whether you're being just released from jail or from that situation of the arrest of at an encampment, that they are given an opportunity into a better spot, into a warm handoff, into some sort of treatment or case management or something that will help them get into a more successful. And then ultimately, we need to do better about not releasing people into homelessness. I'm not under the impression that we can give everyone an apartment upon their release, but we need to do better about getting people into shelter, into a better environment, a more stable environment of management, as opposed to releasing them right back into the conditions that got them into jail in the first place. So the street enforcement team, what we've been doing, we are expanding the street enforcement team to a 7-day-a-week coverage. It's just really to get 7-day-a-week coverage. Homelessness doesn't stop at Friday at 5 p.m. It goes into Saturday and Sunday, so we are working on that. Also, which is important, I know, to you all and citizen oversight and to the community, is accountability, right? And I want to make sure that when our folks are out there engaging and working with the public, that there's accountability. So we are working on equipping our team with body-worn cameras. Body-worn cameras is something that I think will be integral upon them when they're engaging our folks. And to have that accountability and have that transparency, and what do those engagements look like when we are out dealing with encampments and other types of responses. I'm also working on some other policy decisions on how their complaints about them. So let's say we get complaints about them. How are those going to be handled? I definitely want to talk about those with you at future meetings and with you all and get your input on what that looks like, because I do want to make sure that there is oversight of that and what that looks like. I want to make sure that there's not issues of whether there's transparency about how complaints are being handled. And this institute, or this is a function of the Department of Safety. While it's not uniform, it is going to be a forward-facing function. It's going to be interacting with the public. And with that, I think there needs to be transparency on how we are accountable to any misconduct complaints or any sorts of complaints from community regarding that. So that's something to be coming, and I really want, and you will be part of that and part of that policy making process. We really talk, and I talked about here, I'm just kind of looking through my notes to make sure that we go through. So I think I've discussed this. There's a range of city services. There's a range of city services around the around, you know, when we're talking about response to homelessness. And it's not just, you know, SAT or any other team that does this, right? We have the host, Department of Host, they contract through other providers like, you know, Denver Street Outreach Collaborative, Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, and things like that. We also work with other entities like the Department of Veterans Affairs when we encounter veterans that are experiencing homelessness. So those are things that we are working on. I know there's a broad spectrum of people in this, and we're doing our best with the safety response to really integrate with those other models to make sure that we are getting people connected with the right resources. We want to make sure that they are connected with the right resources at the right time. The last thing you want to do is come upon an encampment and someone says, hey, I'm ready for treatment, or I have a methamphetamine addiction, or I have an opioid addiction, I'm ready for that. I really want to make sure that that is something that we can, that we know who to call, that we get them there, and that they're ready to then take the action with that person and get them to that help. So that's something that we work on. Was there any, you know, I should be asking, Daniel, are you monitoring the chat? Are there any questions that I don't want to go to the next topic if I need to answer questions on this?
I think there's one member of the community has asked about whether, you know, about complaints and accountability for the street enforcement team. And you said that they're getting body cameras shortly.
Yes.
If people have complaints about their any interaction that they have with the street enforcement team, is there an avenue for that? Yes. Is it forthcoming? Does it already exist?
No, there is one now. I mean, now it's like with any other career service employee, if there's a complaint, they will be investigated. They will be investigated by our HR department. They would do that. What I'm looking to do and is really expand. And one thing I needed to also clarify is the street enforcement team has not been in an enforcement capacity yet. They're not writing citations. So that has been something that we've been waiting on uniforms. And I hate to keep saying it because it bothers me as much as anyone. I'm the one that, and it's something that our vendor and supply chain and all those things that we've learned through this COVID environment, I keep getting excuses on, but I've been told that we are in the embroidery process, and that's the embroidery of their names. I want to make sure that they have their names so that when someone does have a complaint, they said, I was contacting, you know, Saldate was on his shirt, and this was the person I was doing. So that is that. So when they, it's for me, it's important that when they are in, that they need to be in uniform and they need to have body cams when we get to that enforcement process. So that's something that if there are complaints about that we hopefully have the body cam that will show that and that we can get that. That process, I want to make it, and that's what I'm developing now. I want to make sure that it's just like our uniform services where they can get complaints forwarded, that it's an easy, low barrier process. If they have a complaint, if they have something that they want to, that we can get, that we can track, and that we can make sure that we're addressing. And then I have openness and transparency with you all about that. You know, they don't fall under the authority or scope of the monitor, but that's something I'm willing to look at. Is that something that we should do? Is that something that I don't want to, you know, obviously that's something, that's why I wanted to talk about it with you all and maybe even talk about it with our monitor, our new monitor, whatever that is. I'm open to that. That's what I'm trying to say. I don't want this to be an entity that there is some mistrust or they don't think that we are, if there are complaints and if there are that. So if there are those now, those can always be forwarded to the Department of Public Safety and or directly to me, or I would say, you know, you could always send them. And in fact, we have had, there are complaints that come in about encampments, not necessarily about, I would say, the street enforcement team per se, but if you do want to contact the monitor, they do forward me those things, like about encampments and things, I do get those. So definitely that's something that I want to work on. Did that answer the question? Were there any more, Daniel, or do you want me to go on to the next topic?
I think we might want to pause for a second to see if there's a board member follow-up. Yeah, I had a few myself. I'm just trying to capture the scope of how we are addressing homelessness. Many of us saw the article with the, 1,000 plus arrests at like Union Station. And you're naming things like outreach, the Wellness Winnie, which I heard a little bit more about in a meeting in the last week, and a lot of the incredible outreach they're doing there. You're talking about the street enforcement team. I'm just having trouble kind of grasping why are we still having kind of this, what many people might name this criminalization of homelessness. Why are we having so many arrest when we think we're putting these resources into place? You gave some examples of just thinking about our connectedness and how we connect to people. You named, substance abuse and people being addicted. I more labeled it as trauma. A lot of people have experienced trauma in addition to homelessness and mental illness, and maybe that makes it challenging. So I'm just trying to figure out how do we get these numbers down if we are implementing so many resources, and as we're tracking data, is all of this working, or do we need to, and the answer is yes, do we need to also tackle the issue of we need available housing and available follow-up when they leave the jails and things like that?
Yeah, and I was trying to get to all that too. I mean, I was in my response, I talked about that. Specifically, we need to do more of that. You know, we need to make sure that we're not releasing people into homelessness or back into those conditions. That is definitely something I totally agree with. One thing that's hard for me to talk about, like available housing and all those things, I'm the public safety director, right? I do not control the funds that come in through 2BE tax and through all that stuff. I do not control housing vouchers and the spacing and safe outdoor spaces, right? I am telling you, those help. When we can get people a house, when we can get people into shelter, when we can get into people into, more importantly, permanent supportive shelter situations that can support folks that are in trauma, that are experiencing addiction and all those other things, that is, it helps safety. I don't want to have that we're arresting someone for using fentanyl or buying or dealing fentanyl in these locations. I would rather have them be housed and more stable and not have this, right? But I can't, I'm not the one to be asking about, is there affordable housing? Is there this? I can tell you, yes, all that helps. All that helps. And we still have to do our job in responding to crimes and doing those things and the violent crime that sometimes surrounds this. We had a shooting at an encampment the other day, right? Where three people were shot, and these were folks in the encampment that one of the suspects from the shooting was in the encampment. So there's obviously a public safety element to this as well. And there are crimes occurring at these certain things. So I can't say, it's just one without the other. All this needs to be integrated better. And I think if we did have more, housing and all these opportunities available, that yes, it would impact public safety. We wouldn't have it on the scope that we have it today.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of how are we reducing against some of the criminalization aspects. Again, you were selling me on kind of the outreach components, but we're still seeing these high arrest rates. And so I'm kind of just stuck there.
Okay, I understand that. I get it, but there are still crimes being committed, right? And there are things that do take public safety and that we need to, if there's violent crime, there's going to be an arrest, right? That's what's going to happen. And I get that. And I get that. It's not like we are going out to every encampment and arresting people for camping. That's not happening. That's not happening at all.
And maybe it's some of that too. Maybe you can tell me, or your staff can tell me, when a person is arrested, I'm sure we're documenting that maybe they're unhoused or don't have an address.
Yeah.
Do we have some data on what their arrest, how many of those arrests are there, and then what are people getting arrested for? so we can have maybe some of that clarification, because in my mind, some of those arrests probably at Union Station are things like trespassing or like loitering type of things. But I don't know entirely because I don't have that data in front of me.
Yeah, those are definitely data that we track and we can get from the jail. That's jail data. I will tell you, we're trying to get we're trying to get better at tracking those that are truly experiencing homeless versus they just didn't want to give an address when they got arrested, right? Trying to figure out, you know, those folks experiencing homelessness. And we're doing that really intentionally in the programming that DSD is doing, right? In their programming, trying to do, you know, really good screenings of folks and the things that they're doing. So when they're delivering programming, or if someone, one of the things the jail's working on is having housing navigators for folks that are on release. And that's something, like I told you, is very important. And so to know that, to know who do we need to navigate, we need to know who's homeless and what kind of situations those are in. So we are working on that, definitely coupling that with kind of those crimes. I'll also go back and point y'all back to, maybe some of you are aware of the Urban Institute Social Impact Bond. Are you all familiar with that project? That tells a really good story around that, because what that was and what was the genesis of that was seeing people that were high resource utilizers across our system, people that were frequently in and out of jail that were also experiencing homelessness. And they did a randomized control trial of this. And then when we got people into shelter and housing, and how that reduced jail bed days, right? And that is something that we can learn from, and we need to learn from, and we need to be, so looking at that data and looking at that is definitely something we can do, and I can provide that for you.
Thank you. And kind of relatedly, on the 112 recommendations, one that's, I believe it was like in progress area or needs to be done, was number 50, and it was creating an app to access alternatives to behavioral health crisis. What do you envision that looking like?
So yeah, that one I'm familiar with. So we did, and there was a time, and we had worked, and it was an application. It's called the resource application. I can have that. So a couple of years ago now, it was pre-pandemic. One of the analysts in our department, he's actually the analyst that worked that developed the dashboard for this. He did a resource map that was connected with why can't I think of their name right now? I'm sorry.
Is it Remerge?
United Way. I'm sorry, the United Way.
Okay.
Surprise, it was connected with United Way 211 and all their services. And what it did was, it was a GIS application map where you would get on your phone and you would then say, okay, I'm an officer or I'm a social worker, I'm here. What are the resources around me? What are the resource providers? What are nonprofits, whether it's for food assistance or for mental health assistance and things like that? So those are things we are working on and trying to develop, because I think that's a really good idea. We need to be better about employing technology around that and making sure that it's at our fingertips of these helping and assistance, because as we know, there's a lot of services out there, but the messaging around them or what's available isn't always accessible, particularly to people that are in need, that need that type of service. So that is something that I know is being worked on right now. I can get an update on that as well. Because what happened with the last part of it was, we had it up and running, but then something happened with our connection with United Way or some sort of thing that it fell offline and it wasn't being updated. So I think that's something I definitely like, and I like that technology. I like the ability for, whether you're an outreach worker or whether you're a police officer or whether you're a medic responding to something, and you can connect someone to something that's close by the nature of an app.
And you said we are working on it. That's public safety. And do you still have other partners involved in this effort?
Yes.
And who are they?
I think we're going back to United Way and other, I think there were other, I want to make sure I get them right, but I know that we're working with the maybe Human Services and other agencies in regards to that.
And sorry, I'm asking so many questions.
Board member. No, please.
With this app, will it also be kind of publicly available? So if I have—
I think that's the purpose, is that it's publicly available as well. Yeah.
Okay. I'll stop there if there are other board member questions or follow-ups. Otherwise, I did have one more comment. If sure. I'm taking up space. It's more of just like a reflection of thinking about the park closures. You know, I'm in Denver, kind of District 4, a little bit south. And with those park closures, I'm seeing more unhoused folks pushed out into my area than I've ever seen before in the time that I've lived here. I don't know what that is going to mean for displacement of folks. And when they are a bit south of the city, they're placed away from resources like the Harm Reduction Action Center, like some of the shelters. So again, I know you said this was a parks decision, and maybe we need to also set up a meeting with those folks, but I'm just worried about those concerns, because when we're talking about crime and recidivism, when we push people away from the resources that they need, things happen. And so that's one of my biggest concerns with some of the park closures, with some of the displacement that's happening around the city.
Yeah, I'll tell you that, and I don't know if it's causal by the park closures, but I think we've seen, and we're probably going to see, the point in time count was conducted in January this year, and I think what we're probably or likely going to see is an increasing number in people experiencing unsheltered homelessness. I think that that there has been a growth of encampment or people experiencing homelessness, whether in RV encampment, particularly down where you're at, and those types of situations across the city. We're seeing it, you know, not, it used to be concentrated downtown. I'm seeing it in all points of the city, in every district, and we're seeing more and more of it. And I think it is, we are seeing more of it. I don't necessarily know the reason, but I am really interested in seeing the point in time count. And also, you know, we do experience more, I think historically, and I know because we don't have a point in time count also in the summer, but I know we do experiencing, at least anecdotally, more folks out in homelessness in the summer months than we do in the winter months. But that is something, yeah, I have definitely seen as well, just by the nature of the number of complaints that I've gotten from places where I didn't historically get them before, just saying a year ago, as opposed to now, and particularly in the places you're just talking about.
Thank you. I think that was last for me. Again, for community members who are attending, you can put your questions in the Q&A and we can get to them now. For those watching on Channel 8, once again, you can email your questions to cob@denvergov.org. Daniel, have we received any questions through that vehicle yet?
So there was one other question you all had for me, and this was talking about recruitment and retention within the Department of Public Safety. And so this is something that has been, you know, it's been something that we are working on very hard. And we were especially felt this during the pandemic, or the height of the pandemic, especially earlier this year when we're dealing with the Omicron variant. So we had already stretched resources in our jail. You know, we have staffing shortages in our jail. We had it in our police department. And so when we had people that were getting exposed, or when we had really high case numbers in COVID, we really saw this and really felt this with our staffing, and particularly when we had people out sick or that were exposed to COVID. We've done a lot in this space. We're working hard. The team here, our Office of Human Resources for Safety, are working on a lot of methods around our recruiting. So let me highlight the three, you know, every one of our departments and every department across the city, and even corporations, you know, they're dealing with this great resignation, right? People, through the pandemic, there's just a different outlook in workforce and who's been available to work and who's not. It really has touched hard on our first responder agencies. So 911, we have had critical shortages in 911 staffing, you know, a 24/7 operation where they're working nights, weekends, midnight shifts, dealing in a very difficult environment where you're answering calls of people, you know, experiencing crisis, has been tough to recruit and retain folks in. We've done things like recruitment bonuses and those types of things. And we are seeing more staffing in that area, but we still aren't where we need to be. Also in our sheriff's office, you all are very familiar with that. You have been part of that, and that is really having our Denver Sheriff Department has historically had a lot of vacancy numbers. Working in a jail is very difficult. Then when we put it the congregate setting of COVID and what that, you know, the risks that that posed, and really it's just become challenging to get deputies retained and recruited into that. We are working on that. The sheriff, our staff, you know, we're talking about this as not only being a recruitment, what I think sometimes lost in that, you have to retain the people you have. You can't keep losing them. So we are working on things like bonuses, on appreciation and things for them, a better workplace condition for them, just trying to help, you know, bring an environment better that we can retain that. We're also looking at it from a finance lens, right? We're looking at, you know, things like benefits. Before, you know, they had to pay for parking. When the ones that worked here at Downtown Detention Center had to pay for parking, we've done things like provide parking for them and other things like that. So we're trying to work on that to try to make this a better environment for them. Also in streamlining our recruiting processes, anyone that's gone through the city process of even getting through your process, just being appointed to your board, I think can be cumbersome and background and all those things. It's a tough process to get through. And so we know that when you're competing with other agencies and you're competing with other employers, if you're dragging on a process, you're going to lose a candidate if it's too long. So we're really trying to streamline those processes to make sure we're still getting good candidates, make sure we're still doing the right vetting of those candidates, and make sure that we're getting the right people, but also making sure that it's a streamlined process. We also are really one thing, particularly like with our Denver Sheriff Department, and really proud of the diversity that we're also, you know, we want to make sure that we are also recruiting the diversity that represents the community that we serve. And so that's something that we're looking at and we are constantly striving to do. We have brought the Office of Social Equity and Innovation into a lot of our processes to help us in this vein and to help us make sure that we are recruiting strategically in that. The other thing that we're doing is, and one thing I did, one of the first actions I did in when I got this job was, you know, before we had certain criteria or certain automatic disqualifiers for folks. One thing that I've learned when I was working, especially in homelessness outreach and things, is that folks with lived experience, can bring so much to the table in offering services to folks. I work closely with substance use navigators, folks that were in recovery themselves. And when they engage folks at encampments, they were able to just have such a, you know, break. They did so well in that space. You know, people with lived experience in homelessness or lived experience in addiction and recovery to go out there and be a substance use navigator. I saw the value of that, and I saw the value of lived experience. Far too often, I think in public safety, folks that may have had a lived experience or let's say a criminal record are automatically disqualified from that. Well, one thing I did is I have a policy now that was enacted right upon me getting into this job that those cases are reviewed on a case-by-case basis now. So instead of someone being automatically disqualified, they are not. They are reviewed on a case-by-case basis. And we do have someone in the Sheriff's Academy that I personally recruited that I knew had one of those cases that would have been an automatic disqualifier that is in the Sheriff's Academy right now, and I hope will be, and I know will be a very good deputy because of their experience. So I hope that will also, you know, we have to look at our workforce differently now. We also have to make sure, and I really want a message to people say, well, you're just lowering your standards. I don't think so. I think we're upping our standards here. I think we're getting people now that will be very good deputies, police officers, 911 dispatchers, and will be good that because of their life experience. Every one of us have made mistakes in our past. And we all have that redemption, right? And it should not preclude us. And if we've made changes in our lives and are now on a better path and are in that, we should have that opportunity. And I hope that this policy will give opportunity for folks to come on and serve our public safety agencies. So that's something that I hope can be helpful in this process. So really, and then there's also some technology that we're trying to leverage. There's this technology that our HR team has asked me to get, and it really supports texting, the ability to stay connected with applicants and people that were candidates that were recruiting via text. We all know how text can be so convenient in so many areas, and it's all part of keeping those touch points up, keeping people informed, so where you don't have to, you know, get in a portal and check on the status or make calls, that you're really up to date as you're going through process via texting. So there's other things that we're doing. We are doing also lateral academies. So folks that are, let's say, a certified officer in another state or jurisdiction, they can come through a condensed academy. But I also want to be careful there, because we also know we don't want these gypsy officers or officers that are going from a problem career somewhere to here, right? So we're making sure that we're also vetting them very well. But we want to make sure that we can also try to do everything we can to work on our recruitment. And we're open to anything that any kind of ideas that folks have. One last thing I want to talk about that I really think is also part of retention is the well-being of our staff. It's not just keeping them, whole financially or making financial incentives. We got to make sure that, you know, our staff is exposed to trauma. That they, you know, whether they work in a jail, whether they're a first responder, whether they're emergency medical service provider, a 911 call taker, they get trauma, they're exposed to trauma. And we need to make sure that as agencies and that we provide the support services for our folks to get, you know, help when they need it, to get supports in that the trauma that they are exposed to. So really, I'm working on getting our well-being and our services of well-being on, so that we're handling those stress and that mental workload that's thrown upon our staff better, so that we have a better, better cared for staff. So that's all part of it too.
Stephanie, I see your hand up. So
yeah, thanks. Thank you, April. Armando. Part of your answer there was responsive to a community question about not having barriers to people with lived experiences and disqualification. So I'm glad you answered that, and I know all of us applaud that. My question is related to that, though. It's one thing not to have these disqualifiers, but it's another thing to get the message out to people and to let them know. I mean, I would think that as a result of years and years of experience with law enforcement, otherwise people would think, well, if I have XY conviction, or if I have this one issue, there's no way I could become a law enforcement officer. What's the best way to get, I mean, again, we welcome this message from you, but what's the best way to get that message out to the community as a whole, so that you're getting better candidates, as you said, which is, you know, folks can be more effective because they've had those experiences.
Yeah. So thank you for that. And thank you for that feedback. One other thing I need to point out too, is we still have a civil service process, right? So for our two sworn agencies, police and fire, they still go through a civil service background process that I don't control, nor does anyone in the Department of Safety, police, or fire department. So that's also a background process that they do. We can solicit and we can ask them to review things and do that. But these are the other positions I do control, like 911, sheriff department, those other type things is where I could really have more on this. I do think there's work to be done though. And I will tell you, Commissioner Niecy Murray, the executive director of the Civil Service Commission, has been a great partner and has partnered with us, including in a Peak Academy event with our safety HR team and our recruitment teams about refining that. But the big part of that is what you were talking about, is that point of how are we messaging that out to our applicants, to our candidates, to our recruiting pools? Are we recruiting from areas that maybe we didn't recruit from before, right? Traditionally, I think law enforcement went to like military recruitment events or those type of things, trying to attract candidates. We need to think outside the box differently. We need to go to communities and do that. I'll tell you, when I was at the Cinco de Mayo Festival, we had a booth there And I was really trying to engage our community and trying to engage folks and trying to talk to young people and talk to them about, hey, these are our policies. These are the career opportunities there. And if you may have had lived experience or some sort of, arrest in your past, please still consider us and be part of that change you want to become. And so we're trying to also do that from more in community engagement. We had a teen academy this past weekend. DPD hosted a teen academy with kids from around the city that came in and got to learn about policing. And about half the class were folks that said that they were interested in policing. Half the class said they weren't, but just getting that out there and talking with them and engaging with them about them. I told them about, hey, we have the opportunity for folks that may have had, something in their past that may have disqualified them before. But I think it is critical that we get that message out better and really be more intentional about in recruiting from folks that may have thought that they were excluded before.
Thank you.
Other board members? Yeah, Karen.
Good evening, Director Saldaite.
How are you?
Well, thank you. I wanted to ask about the recommendations that spoke directly to the revelation that there was a lack of training around crowd control when George Floyd protest occurred. My question is, can you talk about how many hours have been devoted to crowd control training since those protests?
So I don't know that number offhand. I will tell you that there is a, so we are working hard in that. That is something that was clear to us about crowd control and crowd management and all kinds of things regarding the response thereof and the recommendations from the monitor's report. There were that Chief Pazin, the police department, our city attorney's office are developing a strategy to get more training in this regard and how we're doing it. I will get that for you so that you have it all. I don't want to misspeak, and I don't know the specific amount of hours, but that is something that we will get to you and that you can have it for. And I'll make sure the police department provides that, not only what has been done, but what is planned to be done. And I know that there's a whole strategy being developed around that as well.
So can you talk to the kind of preparations that are being made to deal with the prospect of anti-abortion protests when the Supreme Court actually comes down with a ruling?
Yeah, so we've had protests since the George Floyd protests. We've had even from the Roe versus Wade issue, there have been protests these past several weeks, maybe not to the magnitude of a decision like that were to come out. But we have had protests. Our department has trained in that. There are definitely new protocols. Some of the things we were deficient on in the tracking of officers, the training, the actual, the munitions that our officers were deployed with. So things like the 40 millimeter are no longer utilized in those things. So there have been real change since those type of things, the way orders are given. I've attended briefings on some of these protests that we've had since those, and there's a whole new protocol in the establishing and going through that of what is happening. So there is preparation. There are a lot of plans and a lot of developed contingencies in regards to that. So there's a lot being done in that space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The most recent lawsuit that happened at the federal level that resulted in the multi-million dollar verdict revealed inconsistent orders being given from your leadership. What has been done to try to get your leadership team on the same page to respond to protests?
Yeah, so I just want to say one thing, but I will answer the question. I want to be careful. That is litigation that's currently something that our city attorney's office is contemplating appeal. So it'd be improper for me to, but I'm not going to talk about the litigation itself or the verdict, but I will talk about what you just said about, that there has to be clear messages and orders given And that has to be clear. And that was a deficiency identified in the monitor's report in regards to the response to George Floyd protest. Those are things that are being clearly, I see it when we are preparing and in the protests that I've been, I've been at the briefings. Those are clearly articulated now. Who's in charge? Where are they getting their direction from? Communication is clearly articulated as to which teams or which entities are giving the orders and what's happening. So I have seen those being addressed, those deficiencies being addressed in that we haven't had, any sort of protest like that being in the George Floyd protest. So I can't say that I've seen that environment, but what I've seen in the ones I've seen so far, I've seen clear delineation of authorities, clear communication in the briefings as to where, who was the incident command and those sorts of things.
Okay. Have you updated your communication technology?
I'm sorry, the phone broke up. You said what technology? You said a word before.
Your communication technology, has that been updated?
Updated as in the radios that are used?
Yes.
So the radios that are used, I don't know when the last update was. It is pretty current technology. The latest technology that is being utilized is what is utilized by the Denver Police Department when it comes to radios.
Captain Pazin talked about the problems that they had with their communication among the different channels and the ability to communicate in situations. I was asking if that has been updated.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that for the confusion on the question. So the actual technology, the radios that are being deployed, the digital technology that, the signals that are being used, that is the same as it was back in the George Floyd during that time frame. The problem around communication and channels and people being on different channels and so much going on at one point, I don't think was a technology problem as opposed to a logistics problem on people that were not operating on the same channel, right? There is an interoperability amongst the channel. There are designated things that happen on certain channels. You just have to because of like traffic control will be on one channel as opposed to tactical operations may be on another channel. Those are kind of logistical things. That's not really technology. It's really those things just need to be clearly defined and when an event's taking place that and that communication can be. I will tell you, I know that just by the sheer magnitude of the protest during after the George Floyd murder, I believe that there was just such a magnitude that there was just confusion as to what channel what was on because of the volume of the protests were so large.
Okay.
Can I follow up on?
Sure.
One of Karen's questions, in terms of also, the report of the independent monitor on some shortcomings of the DPD as a result of the George Floyd protest. One of the issues related to the fact that you had other jurisdictions coming in and assisting the Denver police and there not being, mutual aid agreements in place. That required those other jurisdictions to be bound by the processes and procedures of the Denver Police Department. It's my understanding, Armando, is this accurate or not? If in fact there was a large scale protest as a result after the Roe v. Wade decision was issued, that if other jurisdictions then came in, you felt that was necessary to assist the Denver Police Department, that they will be bound by the requirements and the regulations that DPD is bound by in dealing with crowd control and other issues and munitions?
So this is really a question for the police department because this is their operations. But I will tell you in the policy part of that, it is my understanding that, and I've been in sworn service before and mutual aid agreements and all those other things. When you get to how a department is trained, they're trained to their standard, right? Let's say Arapahoe County, they have training standards and a use of force policy that is different than the Denver Sheriff Department or Denver Police Department, right? When we get to the point of that, we are asking for their services or their support, it is a big deal. It's a pretty big thing. They are bound by their policies. And I don't know that we can, if they haven't been trained in ours and been, you know, kind of do that, how they can come under our policies at that point. Now, whether they can come under the operational command of the situation and where they are deployed is controlled by DPD and all that. That would also be the same thing for, like, in certain situations, you may call the National Guard in certain situations. I mean, those are situations that obviously those are urgent crisis situations, but it was my understanding that they were still bound by, there are mutual aid agreements on when they will come and where they will support. Like a lot of those times in those support mechanisms, they are in property, you know, like they will go guard a building or they will do that. They won't be on the forward, you know, crowd control kind of mechanisms when we bring in that support. So I don't know if I'm mistaken there, but I thought that's where it landed on, that they will still be under their own department policies. I've never seen a mutual aid agreement where someone has fallen under, like, let's say the federal government, if we call them the feds, they wouldn't fall under our use of force policies or procedures. They'd fall under what they have been trained on.
Hmm. Okay, well, I had a somewhat different understanding.
Okay, but I may be wrong. I'll double check with the police. I've not seen that anywhere else where you would expect someone that has been trained differently to somehow now then fall under a policy and procedure that may be different than what they've been trained on their whole career.
Okay, I mean, it's disturbing, for example, One of the requirements now that DPD operates under is you have to get approval before certain non-lethal munitions are going to be used on a crowd. And if for example, Arapahoe or Douglas County isn't operating under that same standard, that's problematic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I think I need more clarification. I don't know where that stuff landed, like where they will be deployed. I don't know if they will be deployed in that certain scenario like you just talked about. So I think that's something better for the police department to answer and for Chief Hazen to talk about how that's going to be done. Because I think that's critical. That is something that we need to get resolved. And I just don't have the answer for that. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, I appreciate your candor about that. Yeah.
I guess I had a question a little bit unrelated to that, but I just wanted to I wanted to thank Stefan and Karen for asking some really great questions, and certainly to thank you, Executive Director Saldalti, for being on here with us. You talked a lot about Union Station and the set teams that are waiting for uniforms and all of this, and then also trying to collaborate or streamline access for nonprofits and community members to be the outreach that you want and the change in the community that you want with regard to homelessness. I'm just wondering, you know, if SET had uniforms with the embroidery on there like you wanted, would there be a scenario where there are not 1,000 arrests at Union Station, but instead the SET group goes out first, or like a plan in place for there are encampments, you know, there might be public safety issues, there might be ongoing crime, low-level drug possession, these types of things. But is there a plan in place for utilizing SET, or I also see that there's the early intervention team that deals with homelessness, or collaborating with those other nonprofits that you talked about, to go into a place like Union Station where the press is saying whatever terrible things they were saying about, you know, Union Station and the like, to send in those different groups before sending law enforcement? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they have been. And so that's the thing. I mean, there have been outreach activities at Union Station prior to even the press that it got and everything. There have been. There are times when that's not, there are times where there is violent crime or there's shootings or things like that that police will respond to. And SET is not that response, nor is an outreach response something. But there is definitely been deliberate by this department, by other departments, by our human services organizations, and getting outreach out to these areas first, particularly like encampments. That is definitely what we've really worked hard on, is that the first outreach or the first contact at an encampment shouldn't be by a uniformed police officer. It should be by early intervention team. That's why they're called the early intervention team, or Denver Street Outreach Collaborative, or all these other entities as opposed to. And then when they become, or they become these public safety hazards, or they become these big, or if there's a crime occurring, that's when the police should get there. Those are the types of things that we want. But yeah, there have been that. There have been outreach. Like, outreach didn't show up the first time Mobile Winnie came after all those arrests. Outreach has been out there prior to that. In fact, RTD even has outreach clinicians that they have on their staff. RTD police has had that. It's not one thing or the other. They're not mutually exclusive. They operate in tandem. And I don't think you're ever going to get rid of policing or police response in some things, in some instances. Definitely I want to reduce it. Definitely we don't have the staffing to send police to every problem, nor should we. We've learned, like, through responses with STAR and through other responses, that yes, we can send other things and hopefully get better outcomes and root cause solutioning, as opposed to sending a public safety or police response. But that's not going to negate, sometimes there will be public safety response. There will be someone selling fentanyl is not someone that's a candidate for outreach. They are a candidate for arrest if they're selling fentanyl, something that is going to kill people when they use it. So that's something that we talk about, that is definitely something. And I'm not necessarily focused on the user side of things, but there is definitely a role for policing also in that.
So I guess just a follow up, and I don't know if we're running against time, but I guess when you send these groups like SET or the early intervention team, are you tracking numbers in terms of referral to services? What constitutes a success for you if they're just saying, hey, there are these homeless services, or there's a shelter, or there's this drug addiction services or trauma services? And then alternatively, I mean, law enforcement are in the community. They're ostensibly at these camps. They're talking to these individuals also with trauma. They're at Union Station. Is there a way to track instances where police officers have contact with an individual but determine not to make an arrest, that they are just the user side of it, like you talked about, and we're just going to actually refer them to services? And how do you deem that a success versus there's lots of paperwork when someone gets arrested? Is there any tracking for police were there, they didn't arrest anybody, they referred these people to services, and any follow-up?
Yeah, so I didn't have time in the presentation, but I could talk about, you know, we have the co-responder model. We have clinicians that ride with police. We have the law enforcement assisted diversion, where we do it when there is an encounter with someone that is, let's say, purchasing drugs, and that we can divert them through treatment and resources. Those are definitely things that are tracked and that are done by our police officers all the time. It's something that they work on constantly in getting that out. Our homeless outreach team of police officers were that homeless outreach team that they go out and outreach to encampments and try to get folks connected to services, you know, before arrest or with arrest or doing things like that. So those are things that are done all the time. It's not like they just go out and just arrest people and they just, that's not what's happening. But there is going to be arrest. There's not going to be times where there's just not going to be an arrest. I mean, there are times where people, like, especially when we have victims, where we have assaults, where we have violent crime, there will be arrest. And those aren't necessarily diversion type instances. So, but yeah, there's definitely instances where we have folks that go out, that engage, that bring in our mental health clinicians that ride with them, that are co-responders, that try to get folks connected to services as opposed to an arrest outcome.
No, we are up against time for our meeting today. There was one final question from a community member. How does the AIDS Center figure into these recommendations? I guess the 112 that we talked about earlier. I've seen some expressed concerns from task force members that the AIDS Center isn't in line with the recommendations.
You know, it's kind of general. There's a lot of recommendations. It's in line with a lot of recommendations, and that is diverting people from law enforcement or criminal justice outcomes into community services and community support. That's the whole goal of the AIDS Center, is to provide an alternative outcome to someone that's arrested for a low-level crime. if they can get into an alternative outcome and into that warm handoff, into recovery or into some other situation, as opposed to a booking to jail, I think would probably align with a number of the recommendations.
Okay. Well, we are just at about time. Director Saldante, thank you again for coming to our quarterly public forum. We greatly appreciate your responses to the items. Daniel, who I forgot to introduce earlier, our board administrator for the public, will be summarizing this, taking the minutes down, and we'll follow up on some of those action items for pieces of data that we mentioned earlier. Once again, thank you to the community. Please attend future quarterly public forums, as well as you're invited to our twice a month meetings, Fridays, the first and third Friday at 10 a.m. So please check out our website, and we look forward to working with you all in the future. Have a good night, everyone.
From the airport.
Yes, sir. So just a little clarification on